Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of why the unions failed in Wisconsin, with one-third of union voters supporting Governor Walker, along with nearly half of voters from union households. Les Leopold, the director of the Labor Institute and a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance of Trade Unions and Environmental Organizations, joins us to discuss why a lot of working Americans do not support labor at a time of high unemployment and record disparity in wealth and opportunity in America. Then we'll examine the impact of Citizens United on the Wisconsin vote with a nationally recognized expert on election law and campaign finance regulation. Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, joins us to discuss the unfettered flow of outside money into Wisconsin and the disparity between the financial clout of corporations and unions. Then finally, we will speak with the filmmaker of a new documentary feature, Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? Francis Causey, an investigative journalist turned citizen activist, was a producer and news editor at CNN, and since 2006 has been making her latest film that goes beyond documentaries such as Inside Job and Too Big to Fail in providing a long view of what led up to the financial crisis and capture of our economy and politics by the 1%. Joining us now is Les Leopold, who co-founded and directs two nonprofit educational organizations, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. He designs research and educational programs on occupational safety and health, the environment, and economics. He also serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations. Leopold is the author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Les Leopold.
Thank you for having me.
So, Les, what's your analysis here of what happened in Wisconsin, given that one-third of union members voted for Scott Walker and one-half of union households voted for him?
Well, I think all of us are don't quite recall that about two-thirds is what the Democrats usually get of trade union members in any election. About one-third of trade union members are Republicans. That's just the way it is. So that's not particularly a shocking result.
So what is, though, then the reason for this failure? I mean, a lot of Monday morning quarterbacks are saying that they picked the wrong fight.
Well, I'm reluctant to, trash the kind of valiant effort that's gone on there to try to protect the downward slide of wages and working conditions throughout the for all the working people in Wisconsin. But I think the fundamental problem is the frame that's used to have these fights. The trade union movement can't just be about protecting its own members. It has to be about protecting and enhancing all working people, all the 99%. And that's a difficult thing to do, but it starts with recognizing that the real issue is not that public workers have benefits that are too high or wages are too high. It's the fact that the rest of the state of Wisconsin and across the country, that workers don't have decent wages and don't have pensions. That's the real issue. That's what we need to fight for. And secondly, the reason that there are these budget crunches is a direct result of the Wall Street crash, the reckless gambling that took place, the way that finance is ripping off the rest of the country. And the frame has to be an anti-finance, anti-Wall Street framework. That's what unites the 99%. That's what Occupy Wall Street taught us all. And we have to remember that it was Occupy Wall Street, not Occupy Walmart or some other bad issue. And the American people understand deeply, on some deep level, that they're being had by the folks that they bailed out. Think about this. The people that crashed the economy, the people that basically created all this excess unemployment, the people that are causing the fiscal crisis, they're asking that we sacrifice now to pay back debts that they created. while they get their massive bonuses and walk off scot-free. You know, this is outrageous, and it has to be put in those terms again and again and again. Unfortunately, not enough of that happened in Wisconsin, and not enough of that is going to happen, I'm afraid, in November in the general election.
But Leopold, does this go back to the fact that the outrage on Wall Street, which after just at the time that Obama came into office, the outrage on Wall Street was essentially captured by the Tea Party. They were spawned out of that outrage. The left and the Democrats were asleep at the switch, you know, putting through cap and trade and extraneous bills like that at the time when the economy was in free fall. What explains this lag in the narrative where today the Republicans have a narrative and the Democrats don't?
Well, actually, you're making an excellent point. What happened, I believe this is what happened. The progressive movement over the last 30 years has been issue-oriented. A silo gets constructed, and this is my issue. Gays, minorities, environment, labor, everybody's got their set of issues inside their silo. Along comes the biggest crash since 1929. And people say, okay, we're going to go out there and get Obama elected and Democrats elected. And then everybody went back to their silos. Meanwhile, there's an extra 20 million people who don't have jobs or are underemployed. And someone has to speak in behalf of them and to them. Instead, everybody from the Obama administration on down pursued their own issue. Obama went after health care. You know, cap and trade, as you mentioned, came from the environmental community. Meanwhile, there are all these people who are unemployed, and the Tea Party picked up that anger and that frustration. Jamie Galbraith, I think, said this, and I keep stealing his line. The problem with the Democrats is you cannot be a party both of the predators and the prey. You can't try to appeal to Wall Street and deal with Main Street at the same time. You have to make a choice. And if the Democratic Party doesn't make a choice by November, they're likely to lose. Obama's likely to lose because he's not clearly enough taking on Wall Street and addressing the unemployment problem. It's a tragedy in the making.
So, Les Leopold, again, I'm speaking with Les Leopold, who is the co-founder and director of two nonprofits, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute, and he designs research and educational programs on occupational safety and health, the environment, and economics, and also serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations. He's the author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. So we have this dynamic in place here that's been very successful, and by the way, it's pretty difficult to escape the triumphalism of a lot of Republicans. I mean, I think that Scott Walker is obviously going to become something of a Republican star. Already we learn that Mitt Romney now is out raising Obama in money. That was always considered Obama's best asset, was his ability to raise money. Well, he doesn't even have that anymore. But the dynamic is in place, and that's what the divide and conquer strategy of Scott Walker's was, that to divide public sectors and private sector workers against it, to divide urban middle class against rural poor, sending out the canard that you're paying for the pensions of these other state workers, and you don't have pensions. And as you mentioned earlier, the narrative should be about raising all boats, and that we all should have pensions, we all should have good jobs. But how do you reverse this narrative of having people fight over the crumbs instead of uniting around the idea and demanding living wages and better conditions?
Well, I think my simple narrative to oppose the Republican narrative is this. Wall Street should pay for the damage it has done. Wall Street should pay to put America back to work. Period. The end. That should be our narrative. The Democrats that have the courage to do that, and there are some, will succeed. Those that don't are going to fall, because the other side's narrative is much stronger. But I think the anti-Wall Street narrative also is strong. Look, think about this. This ragtag group of people called Occupy Wall Street created an international sensation. And what did they have? They had three things, and only three things. They had creative tactics, very visual, I'll grant them that. But they had a strong framework, the 1%, 99%, and it really caught on. It really took off. And they went after Wall Street. It was a direct attack at Wall Street. It seems to me that the rest of us, the rest of the progressive movement and the Democratic Party, ought to learn from this, which is that if you want to mobilize the 99%, you have to go after the culprits that took the economy down. I don't think any other narrative stands a chance. It'll all be muddled. As you pointed out, what the polls are showing is that the population can't repeat a Democratic Party narrative, but they could precisely tell you what the Republicans think. That's because the narrative, the progressive narrative, is a mess. So I haven't had a whole lot of luck with this, but I've been going around to progressive group after progressive group trying to say, look, it's simple. It's like a toxic waste dump. Make the person who created the financial pollution, make them pay to clean it up. That's where the money is. Can put America back to work. By the way, for example, how does that work? A small financial transaction tax, a Robin Hood tax on Wall Street, that's enough money so that every single kid in this country could go to a higher education at a public school, a public university or college for free. No more loans would be necessary to pay for tuition. That's how you could frame it. That's the kind of thing they should pay for to put America back to work. It's not that complicated, but you need to have the courage to go after them. And because they're big donors and because they're smart people and because they're on top and people, the Democratic Party people kowtow to them, they're afraid to go after them. And that's going to be our downfall.
Well, Leslie, Paul, just to go back to trying to do a sort of after-action report here on what happened in mm-hmm. Wisconsin. Now, one of the things I understand is that Labor didn't get this preferred candidate, that the candidate they had, Mayor Tom Barrett, had already been defeated by Walker, and he didn't even mention in his campaign, he barely referred to the attack on public sector unions. So he certainly wasn't I don't know who the candidate that the unions wanted, but apparently they didn't get their guy or girl or whatever. Do you know who their preferred candidate was?
You know what? I'm not that familiar with the details, but I tend to think it would have made a difference, a marginal difference, but I don't know that it would have made a 7-point difference.
Right. But what's
I think Wisconsin people were kind of tired of the action.
And the longer it went on, they clearly got more tired of it. And apparently the commercials that basically argued that this was undemocratic, they didn't work here in favor of Gray Davis in California. And Schwarzenegger was able to win, but apparently it had some traction there, that people felt that it was just wrong in terms of the democratic process to recall somebody unless they committed a crime. Not that this guy may have committed a crime, by the way, but we'll find out. So let me ask you though about the other. There's no question that corporations and their allies are being successful in terms of demonizing unions. Unions are on the decline. Corporations have never been richer and they have never had fatter coffers than any other time in history. You've got people like Sarah Palin talking about union thugs. You've got this full-page ad in today's New York Times with a picture of Richard Trumka looking like Mussolini and saying, why is this guy angry, and urging union members to get rid of these corrupt union bosses who pay for elections that the rank and file lose, etc. So you get the feeling that the anti-union movement's on a roll here.
Well, I think it is. There's been a long-term decline of trade unions, and the more beleaguered they get, the more difficult it is for them to speak for the population as a whole. I mean, one of the things that we're trying to do is to get unions to link up with environmental organizations and kind of get out of their bubble and start seeing that what we need is a full employment green economy, and that we can't just be hunkering down and trying to protect this job that's environmentally destructive and that job that's environmentally destructive. We're going to have to move forward. It's going to take it's very sad because working people are going to lose, not just union unionized people, but non-union people as well, are going to lose a lot of clout. They're going to, there's going to be a lot of people who are see their working conditions deteriorate, who are going to see themselves abused by management, because without a threat of a union movement or without a union movement around, management has all the power, and it's going to be very, very difficult on everybody. You know, we hope that there'll come a time when a more a new version of unionism can be put on top of the one that exists right now. A new generation may come in, you know, through these worker centers that are growing up all over the country, and the younger members in unions, and maybe a message can be put together that speaks for Americans as a whole. But we're all going to suffer as the trade union movement continues its decline, and it's and the attacks are going to, I mean, obviously after Wisconsin, the attacks are, it's going to be a major bone of contention in virtually every election. It's happening in state after state. It's sad. It's not good for the country. It's not good for working people. It's a disaster for the 99%. What's going to happen is the corporations and Wall Street are going to make us pay for the damage they created. They're going to talk about shared sacrifice, but they're not going to sacrifice. They're going to make us pay in terms of cuts in Social Security, cuts in Medicare, cuts in Medicaid, cuts in all kinds of social spending. They're going to, you know, deregulation, so there'll be more environmental damage, you know, more environmental disease. We're going to pay for all of that while a second country emerges of the 1% or the fraction of 1%. They live in their own world, in their own bubble, you know, in their gated communities, in their own schools, with, you know, enormous sums of money. That's why this next book I'm working on, called How to Make $1 Million an Hour, is only half in jest. These guys make $1 million an hour. Think about that for a second. Making 1 hour what the average family makes in 47 years. How can we let that go on? We have to, the outrage against that fraction of the top 1% has got to emerge. And that's, I want the trade union movement to be a big part of that. But we all have to be a part of that.
Again, Leslie Appel, co-founder and directs the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. And he also serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and the environmental organizations. So it does seem that following this victory in Wisconsin, the Koch brothers, who were the basically largely responsible for Walker's election in 2010 in the first place, and they've been critically important to his career, they must be feeling good. Walker's feeling good. The Republican Party's feeling good. Mitt Romney's raising more money than ever. They're just getting started. I mean, this is what I just shake my head in dismay. The Republicans are really got their act together. They got a tight narrative, and they're on a roll. And the Democrats are just stunned and incoherent, and it doesn't make any sense, because all of the arguments out there in the real world should be on their sides, that the country, the middle class, is being decimated. The 1% and the worst of the 1% are stealing the country blind. They've already captured our economy and captured our politics, and we're, you know, becoming a plantation economy at warp speed. Hello?
Yes, and guess what? If you read the speeches that Franklin Roosevelt gave in the mid-1930s, like at his second election, it sounds just like you. I mean, he really goes after the money changers in the temple. He attacks the super rich with abandon. He doesn't hold back. But you listen to the Democrats, and they're walking on eggshells. And, you know, the American people understand that. The Democrats have ceased becoming, they're no longer identified as the party of jobs. The fact that they're 20-something million people unemployed and underemployed right now, and that there's not a Democratic Party outrage over that, that they're not calling for mass demonstrations, that they're not pushing to make this a number one issue. That's why there's no identity anymore to the Democratic Party. It looks like, you know, they're just like Republican lights. And that's what is going to destroy the party in November unless they get their act together. There's got to be some outrage, some anger at what caused the problem and why we need to get Wall Street and the super rich to pay for the damage that they created. If they don't have a narrative like that, as you said, it's a muddle, it's a mess, and we're in trouble. We're in big trouble. The consequences of this, we're going to see, the austerity that they're fighting against in Europe, we're going to see it in the United States. You know what? We're going to see it if there's a Democrat or a Republican in, because people, they've already accepted the idea that we have to cut back, even though that's going to make the situation worse and worse and worse.
Well, Leslie,
I suggest, Ian, that you quickly run for office because you have a narrative.
Well, thank you for the endorsement, and thank you for joining us here today, Les Leopold.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Les Leopold, co-founded and directs two nonprofit educational organizations, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. He designs research and educational programs on occupational safety and health, the environment, and economics. He also serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations. And he's the author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the impact of the Citizens United decision on the Wisconsin vote.
I'll get you anything, my friend, if it makes you feel all right. 'Cause I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give if you say you love me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation and is co-author of the leading casebook on election law from 2001 to 2010. He served as a founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Year Journal, and he's the author of more than 80 articles on election law issues, which have been published in numerous journals. His latest book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Hassan.
It's a pleasure.
And clearly Citizens United had an important role in the results in Wisconsin, given the 6.5 to 1 or 7 to 1. It's difficult to get an exact figure on what the imbalance between the money that Governor Walker spent and his opponent spent. But there was a lot of out-of-state money, a lot of super PAC money. I think it's fair to say that kind of money wouldn't have been allowed under prior to Citizens United.
Well, you know, it depends on what the state's rules were before Citizens United, but certainly afterwards, you cannot have any limitation on independent spending, whether it's coming from individuals, corporations, or labor unions. The only limit that the Supreme Court's recognized at this point is limit on foreign money. So we are in a different world right now than we were just a few years ago.
So would it be fair to say then that the Citizens United, where it allowed unlimited funds from both corporations to and labor unions, is that now sort of proved to be somewhat disingenuous? Because it's pretty clear that there's no parity between the kind of coffers of corporate America compared to the coffers of the diminishing cloud of unions.
Well, the Supreme Court did not premise its ruling in Citizens United on any idea about equality or parity. In fact, the court there rejected the idea, as it has more than once in the past, that leveling the playing field or achieving some kind of spending which is proportionate to people's views in society is a permissible interest under the First Amendment. Instead, what the court said in Citizens United is that the only basis upon which you can limit money in elections is to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption. And the court made what I consider to be a questionable statement that independent spending, that is spending that's not coordinated with the candidate, can never corrupt a politician or the political process. It's on that basis, the anti-corruption basis, that the court rejected these limits and changed the rules on the federal level and in many states and localities.
So is there a possibility, Richard Hassan, again, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, and a nationally recognized expert in election law, is it possible I know that the Montana case is before the Supreme Court, and there's some rumors, whether there's any foundation to them, that perhaps Justice Kennedy is having second thoughts about joining the majority opinion in Citizens United. One would think that just evidence from this recent Republican primary would be sufficient to address what you just said, how the court didn't see independent expenditure as a problem or as something that was akin to corruption. In the Republican primary, one individual, Sheldon Adelson, kept one candidate, Newt Gingrich, alive in the campaign, and he effectively split the anti-Romney vote and helped elect Romney. Whether that was deliberate on the part of Adelson or not, it just shows you that one person, one single individual, can literally manipulate an election.
I don't think that it's likely that the Supreme Court is going to use the Citizens United sequel out of Montana to reverse the decision. It just just issued a couple of years ago. Certainly people are hoping for that. I actually think that if the court agrees to hear the case, which we may know as soon as the end of next week, the Supreme Court, a majority, could actually make things worse. We already had an opinion last year involving public financing in a case that got a lot less attention than the Citizens United case, a case out of Arizona, where the court said that you couldn't give extra matching funds to a publicly financed candidate who faces a large outside campaign against him. And that was a way to try and militate a little bit of the effects of Citizens United. And again, on a 5-4 vote, the court struck that down and said that was impermissible. I think that if the court gets its hands on this Montana case and sets it for a full hearing, as opposed to just summarily reversing it and not hearing any case, that the court could well make things worse and shed some doubt on the constitutionality of limits on direct corporate contributions to candidates, which is so far something that has remained constitutional.
So what does this mean then, Richard Hassan? Does this mean that the majority on the Supreme Court simply believe that the power of money is unlimited and it's just too bad and any attempts to level the playing field are impermissible?
Well, the court majority has certainly said that attempts to level the playing field are impermissible. The question before the court is whether or not it wants to consider evidence that this outside money can be corrupting. Right, so that's a different question than about equality and leveling the playing field. In Citizens United, Justice Kennedy, writing for the court, said that independent spending cannot corrupt and cannot create the appearance of corruption. Justice Ginsburg, in a special statement agreeing with the court to stay that Montana decision temporarily, said, we need to reexamine this corruption question in light of what's happened in the 2 years since Citizens United and the emergence of these super PACs. The question is whether the court would actually entertain evidence that could show that independent spending can corrupt. That's a different question than leveling the playing field, but it's an urgent question as well. I just think that this Supreme Court is unlikely to be willing to look at such evidence. And in fact, they've shown no second-guessing or reluctance about their Citizens United opinion in the 2 years since it was issued. I actually think that they're actually quite happy with how things are going right now.
So Justice Stevens, in his dissent to Citizens United, was quite passionate and I, to my mind, was extremely cogent, warning about the effects that have come to pass. And he recently went public and castigated them. And that, I don't think that's ever happened, has it? Has a former Supreme Court justice ever gone out and gone public and castigated his fellow justices?
Well, it's rare, but Justice O'Connor herself has said a little more subtly that she's not happy with Citizens United. She was, of course, the fifth justice in the majority that upheld the corporate spending rules when they were challenged back involving the McCain-Feingold law in 2003. But Justice Stevens has been going around giving speeches where he's really gone into detail, and he pointed out something which I've been saying for the last few years, that the Supreme Court has said it's created some kind of coherence in the law because now there are no spending limits at all for anyone, and it used to be that you could have corporate spending limits but not apply to media corporations and that this was inconsistent. Well, now the Supreme Court has said that it's fine to have spending limits when it comes to foreign individuals and foreign governments and foreign corporations, but not as to domestic individuals or corporations. And if you think about why that is, why the identity of the speaker should matter here, it's really in great tension with what the court said in Citizens United, that the First Amendment doesn't care who the speaker is not concerned about problems of the political process being distorted by lots of money. Justice Stevens has been out there saying these cases are in tension, and eventually the Supreme Court's going to have to back off of Citizens United. I just think for that to happen, we're going to have a change in the Supreme Court's personnel. It's going to have to be a different five-justice majority to reverse that case.
Well, but if Mitt Romney becomes the next president, and there are two likely seats that may come up, then you'd have a 7-2 majority, a conservative majority.
Well, that's right, and I've been saying that I'm surprised that President Obama has not been talking about the likelihood that you'd have Kennedy and Scalia, both of whom I believe will turn 80 during the next 4 years, agreeing to retire if the next president is Romney and not Obama. But the issue of judges doesn't seem to resonate as much on the left as it does on the right, and perhaps it will not get him any votes. But I do think that there's a danger of going from a wobbly 5-4 to a much stronger 5-4, and not to mention the possibility that someone like a Justice Ginsburg, who has been ill in the past and is older, might need to retire at some point during the next term, whether she would want to or not.
Well, the asymmetry, Richard Hasson, between the right and the left, and the right, of course, and it's worth noting that the judicial appointments advisor to Mitt Romney is none other than Robert Bork.
Well, the right has always had much more of an interest in the judiciary than the left.
Sure, and the left, of course, is a lot of people on the left basically think there's no difference between not a lot, but some people on the left think that there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, and it doesn't matter. Obviously, following the 2000 election in Florida, that led to the appointment of both Alito and Roberts. And you mentioned earlier that Sandra Day O'Connor has been subtly critical. Of course, she was replaced by Alito, and it turns out in her case it was unnecessary in a way. She retired thinking that Rehnquist was going to she asked actually Rehnquist before she whether he was going to retire or she would, and he said, well, go ahead and retire because I'm not, and she went off to take care of her ailing husband, who subsequently sort of didn't recognize her because of Alzheimer's, and then lo and behold, Rehnquist dies, it's pretty clear that O'Connor could still be on the court.
It's true, and I wonder if she has regrets about not being on the court at this point, especially as she's seeing how, in a number of areas, the law is changing. It could not only be changing as to campaign finance, but it could as to voting rights as well and as to affirmative action. So there are all kinds of changes on the Supreme Court that have come and that are on the way.
But just in terms of the Supreme Court's idea that they limit their notion of corruption to foreign money, how in God's name can anybody guarantee that foreign money is not getting into an election if unlimited amounts of money are allowed, and particularly if they're allowed through the 501c4 tax exempt, not a tax exempt foundation, but through the non-profit route, which disguises the donors. In the days of multinational corporations and electronic transfers at the tip of a finger, how could you guarantee that you're not getting foreign money pouring in?
I think that's a very legitimate question. And I suppose what the answer of the Supreme Court would be is that the court did nothing to prevent the passage of more effective campaign finance disclosure rules. And in fact, in Citizens United, Justice Kennedy extols the idea of having a fully open campaign finance system when it comes to money, but with instantaneous disclosure on the internet. Well, we got half of what Justice Kennedy imagined in his world, the unlimited money, but not the disclosure. In the meantime, disclosure has become a partisan political issue, with Democrats and Republicans splitting in both Congress and in the Federal Election Commission, with the result being that anybody who wants to hide their identity while still trying to affect the outcome of elections and influence legislative members has the ability to do so. It's very easy if you want to give your money to help Republicans, instead of giving it to the super PAC American Crossroads run by Karl Rove, you give it to Crossroads GPS, which is their 501c4 affiliate, which allows for the hiding of the identity of these donors. And so far, neither the Federal Election Commission nor the Internal Revenue Service have shown much of an appetite for going after these groups for potentially violating both the Internal Revenue Code and the Federal Election Campaign Act.
So again, Richard Hasson, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation. Just back to the impact of Citizens United on the Wisconsin recall vote. According to Forbes magazine, 14 billionaires made contributions to Scott Walker, and only one of them lives in Wisconsin. That's a woman that we saw on the videotape asking Scott Walker to make turn Wisconsin into a red state and to make it a right to work state. And of these 13 out of state billionaires, one was Christy Walton, the widow of the Walmart founder, and the Walton family can command $70 billion in wealth, which is the equivalent to the wealth of the entire bottom 30% of the United States, people in the United States. You know, that's 95 million people we're talking about. When you look at it that way, it makes you wonder what country the Supreme Court are comfortable about living in.
Well, I want to be clear that I don't believe that Citizens United funding was responsible for the Scott Walker victory.
Oh, I don't believe that either, by the way. I mean, there are a lot of other reasons, and the New York Times has a pretty good editorial about how the unions and labor failed miserably in this.
Right. So, but, you know, the real issue with this kind of spending in a high salience race, like for the president or for this Wisconsin recall, is not that it's going to affect outcomes, because you're going to have both sides being able to get their message out and being able to be at least somewhat effective in getting the vote out and getting the message across. The bigger danger is that politicians are going to, one, feel the need to kowtow to the big contributors to these super PACs and to these groups. And second, they're going to fear that if they don't change their views and change their policies, they're going to be the next victims of this kind of outside spending against them, which could cause them to either change their positions directly or have to make compromises in order to raise the kind of funds from their allies, which they otherwise wouldn't do. And so the biggest problem with Citizens United, to me, is not its effect on electoral outcomes, but much more its effect on legislative outcomes and public policy.
Well, Richard Hasson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Hassan, who's the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation, and is the co-author of a leading casebook on election law. And from 2001 to 2010, he serves as the founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal. And he's the author of more than 80 articles on election law issues published in numerous journals. And his newest book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with the filmmaker of a new film, Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Francis Causey, who's the co-director and co-producer of a new film, Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? A seasoned investigative journalist, she has emerged as a citizen activist after a 14-year career with CNN as a producer, news editor, and senior member of a team honored with news and documentary Emmy Awards for team coverage of both the Olympic Park and Oklahoma City bombings in 1995 and 1996. Additionally, she directed the Wendell Scott story, which appeared on the History Channel and the Turner Networks. And she's recently honored with the Women's International Film and Television Jury Award for her work on Heist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frances Causey.
Thanks for having me.
And the film, I mean, the New York Times have said that the virtue of this film is that it gives you a long view of the crisis that recent films like Inside Job and Too Big to Fail have only sketchily explored. And it makes, of course, a strong case that government regulation of business is essential for our democracy. Was that your idea in taking this on, to follow on from these important films like Inside Job and Too Big to Fail?
Well, actually, we started, my co-director, Donald Goldmacher, and I started almost 6 years ago. And so we were on the story, kind of, I think, probably well before Inside Job, although I don't know that for sure. I don't know when he started, but Charles did. But what we wanted to do, Ian, more importantly, is rather than pick off, cherry pick, you know, one aspect of kind of the calamity that had befallen the country, like the financial crisis, we really wanted to connect the dots for our viewers of the history of kind of where we've been, where we are now, and, you know, how we got there, and maybe more importantly, kind of where we're going. So our film really goes much deeper than looking at one part of the crisis. For instance, we look at, the history of starting in 1973 with the Powell memo, and gradually how this plan by, you know, kind of an ultra-extremist kind of group took their money and kind of set about to shape policy, to kind of, you know, very small number of people controlling the economy for their own personal gain. And, of course, in the process that was outsourcing and, manufacturing flight, and that is the impact on the middle class. And so I think our film is really the first to do that, to really connect the dots for people.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Francis Causey, the co-director and co-producer of the new film, Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? But in many ways, though, you dig into how this was achieved politically. One of the people in your film is the father of Reaganomics and a key Clinton economic advisor, Alan Blinder. So, I mean, the film itself, of course, is replete with a lot of people that I've spoken with regularly on my radio show, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, David K. Johnston, Robert Kuttner, historian Gar Alpovitz, Van Jones. I had him on yesterday, as a matter of fact, Francis.
Right, great.
So let's start with Alan Blinder. Give us a sense of how this was achieved politically, this heist, this coup, where the 1% took over America and downsized the middle class and impoverished working America.
Well, for instance, I mean, Blinder's a great example. And we connected with Dr. Blinder because he had written a paper in 2005 for the Council on Foreign Relations where he talked about this third industrial revolution where all of the, and he actually says, and I'm kind of amazed this doesn't elicit more reaction from our audiences, but he says in the film, you know, because of broadband, you know, we're going to lose another 30 to 40 million jobs. And these are white collar jobs. And so he talks about, but what's ironic is, you know, we say to him, you know, have you ever actually talked to a displaced worker? And he, you know, he's very matter of fact about it. And this is a man who was, you know, vice chairman of the Fed under, you know, in the Clinton administration. And he, you know, he calls himself a, you know, all economists are free marketers, he says. And this is somewhat of the problem because, you know, we've looked at everything through this free market fundamentalism prism for so long. You know, things like comparative advantage. Well, comparative advantage was working for a while. I mean, you know, the country was under that for a while, where the idea that, you know, we do well at certain things and other countries do well at certain things and we each kind of do our own thing. Well, they've basically outsourced all of the things that we were particularly good at. So these kind of old economic principles, you know, people claim that we still have those, but if you actually look at what's happened with the country, we've had a huge amount of outsourcing and deregulation that has led to, you know, pretty much open season on the American middle class.
Well, as your film, Francis Causey Heist, Who Stole the American Dream, points out, the plan really got underway, even though it was hatched in 1971, it really got underway with the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And the first thing out of the gate that Ronald Reagan did was shut down PATCO, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, and basically busted the union. And it's interesting that just a few days ago, Scott Walker, who just won the recall battle in Wisconsin, made an address on what would have been Ronald Reagan's 100th birthday, I think, saying that on this day, of course, we all remembered how Ronald Reagan took on the air traffic controllers, and
I mean, it was really clear. I mean, once they in 1978, you know, they went after the unions. Orrin Hatch gave that filibuster speech that, you know, business outspent organized labor or something like 10-1. And so by 1978, they had already begun to really go after unions. And this is clear. Jeff Foe says it from the Economic Policy Institute. He says it beautifully in the film. You know, there's just no doubt that when Reagan came in, unions and the power and economic might of the middle class was a target.
Well, it's interesting. In today's New York Times, there's a full-page ad, a picture of Richard Trumka, that making him look like some sort of Mussolini-type demon, saying, right, why is this man so angry? And basically, it's an appeal by some amorphous pro-business group to union workers, saying your unions have betrayed them in Wisconsin, they've wasted your money and your dues, etc., and we need to reform unions. So it's not as if they're satisfied with a victory in Wisconsin.
Right.
They really want to destroy the unions, and after all, you know, the union membership has dwindled to 1 out of 14 from 1 out of 3 in the 1950s.
Right. Right, and this is a really important point. What's one of the main mandates of unions? It's educating their membership on the current legislative issues, keeping their membership informed. And the ultra right, I mean, this faction of the right of the GOP understood that. They understood that that's how you disempower people, and you also do it. Probably one of my more favorite parts. I'm an exile from corporate news, being a former CNN producer. Probably one of my more favorite parts of the film is our segment on media. So we went from 50-something companies in the late 80s, early 90s. We now have 6 companies that control all of the content that people watch on their television, see in the theaters, and they understood this. You control the message, and they've so gutted the news gathering capability of journalists to actually go out. I mean, you can't make a living anymore and actually tell important stories. It's very difficult. Even in an Obama White House, if you ask a tough question, you get your credential pulled. So, and the news gathering operations have just solely become money-making machines. And so there's 6 companies right now. And what that's done is created this kind of acquiescence. I mean, it used to be that they kind of stretched the truth. Now they just tell out and outright lies because nobody holds them accountable, for asking those questions.
Again, I'm speaking with Frances Causey, the co-director and co-producer of the new film Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? A seasoned investigative journalist, she has emerged as a citizen activist after a 14-year career with CNN as a producer, news editor, and senior member of the team, honored with news and documentary Emmys for team coverage of both the Olympic Park and Oklahoma City bombings in 1995 and 1996. Well, interesting, Frances, what you were just telling us is very much echoed by this billionaire, Nick Hanauer, who's the first non-family investor in Amazon. He recently gave a talk to TED, which they kept on the shelf because they didn't want to release it. They thought it was too controversial in election year. And out of the mouths of a capitalist, he's saying that this is a myth about these giving tax breaks to billionaires. They're the job creators. If that were true, we'd be drowning in jobs at the moment, and that capitalists don't want to hire people. And the only reason that they hire people is because there's a demand for their products. And until there's a demand for products, and until the middle class in this country has money in their pocket to buy products, the economy is going to stagnate. And, it's just so logical. But, boy, I don't see that narrative out there, but for a handful of billionaires that aren't the worst of the 1%, what the hell's wrong with the Democrats and the president? Why can't they come up with a narrative to counter this ludicrous canard?
Well, I mean, the issue, of course, it all comes back to money. I don't know how many politicians I've known a few, and they really all want to be, for one thing, primarily, which is to be reelected. And David K. Johnston had a great piece up on Reuters. As you know, he's in the film, and he's dynamite. The IRS numbers, are out, and there were 6 families who made over $200 million last year that did not pay 1 cent in taxes. So what you have is this. Well, this is another thing I think Americans have a hard time understanding. We've had such a transfer of wealth on such a large scale that really, a tiny fraction of the country holds all of the key to policy and to lawmaking. I mean, we ostensibly are a country of laws, but when you have, Citizens United, what better example do you have of how one person, a casino owner in Las Vegas, could resurrect the candidacy of Newt Gingrich? I mean, it's very scary. But here's the thing,
Frances.
Go ahead.
I was just going to, don't mean to interrupt, but I have actually quite a different take on that. Sheldon Adelson's best friend, and literally this guy worships, Adelson worships Netanyahu. He set up a Fox network in Israel dedicated to promoting Netanyahu, and he also publishes a free newspaper in Israel that's dedicated to Netanyahu. The point being that Adelson helped split the anti-Romney vote by funding Newt Gingrich, and Gingrich and Santorum's vote was split, thus allowing Romney to get the nomination. The point is that it turns out, according to the New York Times, it did some investigative piece on this, that Netanyahu and Romney have been friends since the 1970s, and they're very close. So it doesn't take more than an inquiring mind to figure that if Romney's best friend is one of his best friends is Netanyahu, and if Adelson's worships Netanyahu, it's not difficult to understand that they may have been actually working for Romney, not for Gingrich. That's my point.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay.
I mean, this is one individual. I mean, let's remember, there are a lot of sub-themes and a lot of things that we could talk about, but this is really about restoring our democracy.
Right.
That's what it ultimately is about. And I think if people, I don't think Americans want to believe that this is what we've, you know, become, because I think in many ways Americans think they too can be an Adelson or a, you know, and what they've done is they've stolen the ladder and the rungs to the ladder, and that's a very difficult thing for people to understand, that is where we are, which
sure.
is what Gar Alperovitz said so well in the movie. I mean, we have the most corruption in our country that we've had in 100 years, and Crandall says it beautifully. People don't want to believe this, but votes are bought.
Right.
And the way that we do that, you know, the way that we, I think, get out and show our displeasure, first we have to understand, which is why we made the movie, and then we have to mobilize it, which is why I'm at, you know, Netroots Nation, you know, meeting with organizers, urging them to use the film. The film is available if you go to heist-themovie.com. We have made it turnkey for activists, for groups, for unions to use the film. And because I think we have to break through this kind of deer in the headlights. I think, you know, people are really struggling to understand what's gone on, and that's why I'm proud of the film that Donald and I made, because it just really is that in-depth TikTok kind of you know, we really spent a long time making sure we got it right. And people can get it in one sitting in 75 minutes.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I know you're busy at the Netroots convention, but we're very grateful for your film, Frances.
Well, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Frances Causey. She's the co-director and co-producer of the new film, Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? She's a seasoned investigative journalist and has emerged as a citizen activist after a 14-year career with CNN as a producer, news editor, and senior member of the team honored with news and documentary Emmys for team coverage of both the Olympic Park and Oklahoma City bombings in 1995 and 1996. And she recently was honored by the Women's International Film and Television Jury Award for her work on Heist. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was